Time to check in with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for a Tacky Talk. We missed you last week, Tacky. How are you?
Yeah, doing good, Joe. Happy to see you. Last week, I attempted to do a staycation with some limited degrees of success. I probably should have just left a meeting scheduled for you last week. It would be part of my recreation.
I'm glad I'm able to provide a little levity to your day with these talks. But I mean, my gosh, really the world has changed, Tacky, since last we talked in just the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, every time we come on a call, it seems like the world changes on a dime, on big events beyond just being at home. And obviously a lot, myself and everyone around us have been watching glued to the television and your cell phone and your tablets and any other medium you have about what's going on in Ukraine. And it's just heartbreaking to watch what's unfolding there, especially watching the refugees come across the border, just trying to flee because the uncertainty what's going to happen there, and watching families being broken up and their dads and uncles and granddads going back after dropping them off to fight. And Ukrainians around the world are now flying back to Ukraine to join the effort. Something we haven't seen probably since World War II, this level of mobilization of folks seeking to go to a war for a right and justice cause of your homeland. And it's been a long time that we've seen something like this. And for those that are a little too young, don't fully understand that if you lived under the Soviet occupation, this is something you don't want to do twice in your lifetime.
Yeah. Are you familiar with any impacts either here in Quincy or in your colleagues at the State House with Ukrainian connections, Tacky?
I don't know a whole lot of Ukrainian folks. I suspect a lot of people do. We do have a sizable population of people from Eastern Europe as a whole. Actually, in Quincy, we do. Quincy Point does have a sizable number of folks from Eastern Europe. I do suspect that there are folks in Quincy that are Ukrainian or have friends or come from the geographic region to probably give you much better insight culturally, historically, about how people think out there and their response to Russia. Those who know, I went to Brandeis. I went to Brandeis after the fall of the Soviet Union, because I was still in high school. I do remember the wall going down, and we spent like 3 days in history class talking about how the books are being rewritten as we spoke. And Ukrainian Jews, as well as Romanian and Lithuanian and others, were very much part of Brandeis's life at college. But at Brandeis, I talked to people from Romania, talked to people from Ukraine. And then, very one common thing is that they hate Russians. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. It's just that simple. At that time, it's like 1992, 93. I worked in a periodicals room at Brandeis. It was my work study, among other things I work studied. And, there were Jewish folks from Ukraine, and they lived under Soviet occupation, Soviet oppression. To say they hate Russian folks, my experience from 30 odd years ago would be an understatement.
Okay.
To say they hate Russian folks, it would be an understatement. Nothing made them happy when he started tearing down statues of Stalin around the country.
Yeah. It's, and since then it's been a sovereign country, right? It's been self-governed and identified as a country, not a member of NATO yet though.
No, it's a young country. I think most people also don't realize exactly how many new countries sprung up really inside the last 50 years, after the end of World War II, 70 years. So after the end of World War II, a lot of new countries appeared all over the map. The United States suddenly became one of the older nations on the planet, given how quickly, including the People's Republic of China. Communist China is a relatively new country. It really is. You look at all the Eastern Bloc, the former Soviet Warsaw Bloc locations, they all became a country. Belarus, which you've seen a lot in news, is a new country, relatively speaking. They're all less than 50 years old, less than 30 years old in some cases. And this includes all through the Pacific as well. A lot of countries like Singapore, for example, is a country that's, again, under 70 years old, another post-World War II country. Mm. So, you know, in 30-odd years' time, you know, Ukraine is not a superpower economy, not a superpower military, but it is a functional government. It is, despite the fact that, you know, they've had ups and downs, it's actually fairly stable. You know, for those who aren't aware, I mean, the after Crimea invasion by Russia, as well as the eastern part of Ukraine, I think it's Donbas, I'm trying to pronounce things, which is, we all know, is dangerous. You know, they ousted the pro-Russian president by protest. And when the guy started shooting his own citizens, that was it. So, I mean, they've been able to have, you know, like I said, it's not a perfect situation, but you know, they've been able to try to keep stability through quite a rough country. And most people don't realize that, you know, like the United States, like the British, like Russia, one of the ways they deal with occupation or dealing with non-Russian nationals is to do settlement. So, you know, the Soviet Union, you know, and even the old Russian empires, the solution to trying to make an unfriendly location friendly is to displace them by settling them with Russians. Mm. Not an uncommon practice, by the way. This was a very common practice of colonialism. You remove the native population by heavily settling it with locals. And you see, you know, there's a practice you see a lot of, including places like Israel, right? You put settlers in there and you can claim the land as yours because they have residents occupying it.
Yeah. Yeah. So take it from within rather than from without or from outside, take it from inside.
Yeah. So Ukraine actually has a unique culture, but because of, you know, century of plus of Russian settlements under different forms of Russia, you know, there obviously is some level of Russian cultural influence. But it is also very Jewish. People forget that sometimes. And while communism does not like religion on a whole, Jewish folks are an easy scapegoat regardless of what regime or political structure you live in.
Yeah. We're recording this the day after the President's State of the Union speech. He spoke a lot about the situation in Ukraine. Did you have any reaction to that, Jackie?
He went about 11 minutes at the beginning on Ukraine, and he spelled out really the U.S. foreign policy. The speech last night, in my opinion, was a lot of the same speech he's been giving for essentially since the campaign trail. And it again, I remind folks that, you know, Joe Biden is a post-WW2 president. He is heavily influenced by Vietnam, very much influenced by the Cold War. He is indeed, you know, a blue-collar president, family, and he was a single dad. People always forget about him. He was a single dad for a while after the tragedy of losing his wife and a child in a car accident as a very young man. I think it was his first term in the U.S. Senate that happened. And he won a seat that he shouldn't have won. Sounds like a familiar theme in a lot of our lives in politics. He won something he shouldn't as a Catholic in a very Protestant-dominated area. And, you know, some of the younger folks don't realize that religion at one time mattered a whole lot.
Oh, yeah. When Kennedy was elected, a big deal was made about the first Catholic president. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think some young folks listen to understand exactly how big a deal religion is in politics. So he reemphasized again what he's been talking about a lot, you know, the light and the darkness, so to speak, you know, freedom and democracies versus, you know, now we don't say we're communism, but, you know, authoritarianism governments and the need for friends. You can't go it alone. And, you know, I think what has been revealed, and I was talking to this quite a bit to folks last night, is that globalization is not new. I think people tend to like this idea that it's not new. Globalization has existed long as we could get goods from point A to point B. You know, the United States historically has always been a great raw materials country all over the world. Like part of U.S. cuts off a raw product, it hurts the other country. For example, in the U.S. Civil War, the blockades really hurt the French and the English. They couldn't get cotton, couldn't get tobacco, couldn't get a lot of raw product. So, you know, the Chinese and the Russians in particular have been trying to use globalization to push forward their domestic agenda onto other folks and to change their power on the world stage. But both of them also go it alone. They're both countries with almost no political allies in terms of military, nor do they have really economic, true economic allies, like an EU bloc. And I know some people call it the EU is a horrible thing, but because they all think that, you know, this type of economic bloc structure is bad, but it actually maintains peace in a geography that has been torn by war for like 1,000 years. European history is very violent. When you look at it, in the EU, the NATO has created enormous stability to create future wars, as well as obviously fend off the Soviet Union, and also creating a trading bloc that is the second biggest trading bloc on the planet outside of China and the United States, really. It's complicated because the EU trading bloc is like almost 1 billion people. And when you add up all the GDPs, it's actually bigger than China. When you actually really look at it, and you look at the middle class PPP spending power, you know, it is comparable to the US and China's ability, you know, per citizen spending ability. So, you know, people forget the EU bloc is so very important. So why do I say that? As people now seen in news, you know, Russia's created dependency with Europe on natural gas. Natural gas is the only product. We come right down to it, the biggest product they export in Russia is natural gas. They import, they export some raw products and some precious minerals, but natural gas is the big one. And the Europe on a whole doesn't have a lot of natural gas. They have coal, but they're getting rid of coal.
Right.
It was intentional that for Russia to grow, they would have to sell natural gas in particular and to an area that needs it, and it creates economic stability. And Putin was gambling that who needs who more scenario. That's what it is, folks. Who needs who more? Because if you are mean to me, I'll cut off your ability to heat your homes and generate electricity.
Right, and but you also cut off your revenue at the same time.
Converse the other way, you cut off your revenue. So globalization cuts both ways.
Yeah.
And war very much impacts globalization. China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is basically China's foreign policy of providing financial assistance to lower income countries to spend as they will in infrastructure, has now been impeded because Ukraine was their way to get to Europe initiative to try to get to countries that are EU countries and NATO countries, such as Romania, Lithuania, even Italy, on this Belt and Road Initiative. Well, now there's a big stop in the Belt and Road that Russia's created. So obviously, as we've seen in news in the past 7 days, we decided to say to Russia, all right, you know, globalization cuts both ways. You want to play this game, and we're not going to put troops in the ground. We're going to strangle your population. The ruble went from essentially 13 cents to $1 to 0.0092, well under a penny for 1 ruble. And that means your ability to trade from Russia is greatly diminished against the dollar. And, MasterCard and Visa is no longer doing transactions. We talk about the SWIFT. Everyone knows about that at this point, about banking transactions. Nike and Adidas has cut off ties, FedEx and UPS, and they're pretty much running out of airspace to go anywhere. And the French are stopped a cargo ship in the English Channel that's trying to get to Russia. So, you know, this is a full court press by the United States and democracies and capitalist countries united on a front that Russia was hoping would divide us, because, you know, they were hoping the Germans would say, no, let's leave this alone because we need the natural gas. Nord Stream 2's company is now talking about liquidation.
Yeah, I think Germany and also Switzerland were the two biggest surprises in this scenario here.
Divide and conquer is a very old tactic in world history. And I think we can't go it alone, and Europe can't go it alone. But the president is correct. Together, you know, the world changes overnight, and the solidarity of, you know, all of Europe, including a neutral country like Switzerland, which they're now freezing all oligarchs' bank accounts all over the place, was shocking, to say the least. It shows that we can't make a difference in the world against a nuclear power. who feels that since we're so dependent on them, you know, we can, they can do their what militarily. And across the other side of the world, China is watching very, very carefully, being very silent. People can interpret silence as support. People could also interpret silence as unsurety, and people could support the silence as not supporting as well. They've taken this very peculiar position. And they're even more globally collected to the world economy than Russia. So if this was done to them with the Pacific nations as well as the EU, they would be crippled within the first 24 hours.
Yeah. What do you think about the reaction back here in Massachusetts? I know the governor is hedging on issuing some kind of a ban, but he's looking at the way the state, I guess, invests in Russian companies. And I know a couple of your colleagues have introduced bills to that effect.
Well, introducing legislation is kind of an interesting way to do about it. Obviously, you could try to pass a law, but the governor himself has the ability to look at our contracts to begin with. The reality, we break a contract, it's going to be very hard for a Russian company to engage in litigation right now. One, they can't go anywhere. And two, you know, litigation takes a long time. I think people understand that. It's not like, you know, you break a contract and tomorrow morning the court's going to issue an order.
Right.
Secondly, businesses independently, as I said before, FedEx, Adidas, Nike, and so many others have taken action on their own that actually has direct contact with Russia,
mm-hmm.
right? Direct contact on engaging business, and it's going to cost those businesses big money to do that. I know I saw the thing with the vodka.
Yes.
Not all vodka is made in Russia, by the way.
Right.
A lot of vodka is actually made in places like Lithuania. So please check the label. If you decide to boycott vodka, and also that alcohol was already bought by the spirits distributors. So it actually doesn't hurt that Russian business. It's already been sold.
Right. They already got their money. Yeah.
So when it comes to hard commercial goods, the distributors and the retailers already bought the product. You boycotted that product only really hurts the retailer or the wholesaler. Because they already paid for it.
It's symbolic. It's optics more than anything.
Absolutely. Now, whether wholesalers and retailers stop more goods coming over from Russia, the answer is the sanctions already do that for you
mm-hmm.
because they can't get any product out of Russia under sanctions. So whatever Russian product you see on the shelf, unless there's some funky way it's they managed to get here that doesn't involve coming out of Russia directly, maybe it's in a warehouse and in, you know, somewhere else they're getting the remaining supply from. The sanctions solve a lot of that for you.
Right.
But, you know, I hate to say this, you know, my favorite words from Michael Morrissey, as a practical matter, there will be no more Russian products as long as the United Democratic Countries, for lack of a better term, you know, embargoes essentially Russia from stuff coming out and stuff going in. So it really comes down to whether the governments in the United States and major corporations sever ties with their partners in Russia, whether permanently or temporarily. Like BP selling off 20% of one of the biggest oil conglomerates in Russia, selling off 20% of their stock, which is the entire stake in it, plus taking themselves off the board of directors. They're going to sell their stock cheap. I mean, pursuant to obviously the local Securities Exchange Commission, the equivalent that's in England, the equivalent of that, you know, compliance. But I mean, a 20% sell off on stock on the fly devalues the other 80% pretty fast.
Yep.
So, you know, I do suspect that other stockholders, and it tends to be the major corporations, as again, globalization, its way to create partnerships is by owning stock in each other's company. You know, will have a huge impact on the upper end of the Russian food chain economically, the oligarchs, which quite frankly, you know, are the ones that are keeping the Russian economy moving.
That seems to be the bigger goal here, is to kind of pressure those oligarchs to persuade Putin to back down.
But the oligarchs are paying for the war.
Right.
I mean, yeah, they tax the whole country, but the ones that have the most money to tax are the oligarchs. They basically fund the Russian government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this time, unlike other times, you know, our sanctions have always been, trying to be careful not to badly impact, you know, people on the ground. This time is not the case. Every Russian citizen is paying the price for this war on the deflated value of the ruble, the inability to get goods into the country or goods out of the country, suspending all forms of trade, whether you're selling oil or selling small retail. This is crippling already. And you're going to see runs on ATM and money. The Russians have already trying to keep money in country by reducing the ability to move money out to 10,000 US dollars. And I suspect they're going to suspend that at some point by week's end, that you can't move money to the country. And they're going to try desperately to keep people from going to the banks and withdraw. People have seen a wonderful life.
Yes.
You take all your money out of a bank, the bank doesn't exist anymore.
Right, exactly, yeah.
It isn't complicated, folks. It's very simple. So they doubled the interest rate to 20% to try to incentivize people to keep the money in the bank by giving them large amounts of interest. With, I'm honestly doubtful that's going to work. I mean, despite state media propaganda and them basically shutting down social media companies, they're feeling it in the pocket already. You don't need to have media to tell you there's a problem.
Yeah, of course, we're feeling it here as well, mostly in energy prices.
Oh, well, we're feeling it already in energy prices for, like we talked about multiple times, about the rapid growth of the economy and the challenge of starting up and moving our fossil fuels refineries after being closed for so long during COVID in terms of reduced consumption. But, you know, the U.S. imports, I think, less than 10%, I think it's like less than 9% of our fossil fuels from Russia. Yeah, we're going to feel it at the pump. The real question now is whether or not the president is able to ratchet up. Unfortunately, people hate the words, and I don't like the word either, fracking, which is how we were helping the Russians out. Helping Germans out after Crimea. We export a lot of fossil fuels to Europe as part of the first set of sanctions out of Europe during Crimea. And whether or not, we can get OPEC to increase supply. The U.S. is the number one fossil fuel provider on the planet by far. China and then Russia and then the Middle East on the whole. So people have this misconception that Saudi Arabia is the biggest fossil fuel energy provider on the planet. It's actually not true. It's actually the United States by far and none. China and Russia are the big three in fossil fuel generation. So we'll see if we can, if there's any more capacity and infrastructure, because at a certain point, you can't pump more out faster, so to speak. You can't refine any faster. As we move towards renewables, including a bill we're going to go on tomorrow about, changing some of the price structures, as well as providing tax credits for windmill development, offshore windmill development. We'll be voting on that tomorrow. Obviously, the movements towards renewables, but putting a giant offshore windmill that's going to be 300 plus feet tall takes some time to do. So, particularly on a seabed floor, and yeah, it's going to drain a lot of electricity that offsets our need for fossil fuel electrical generation. However, it's still putting over 300 foot structure in deep ocean.
Yeah, it's a Herculean engineering feat for sure.
Exactly. So, I mean, yes, we are moving towards renewable, but again, the infrastructure construction is a huge task. And then, obviously the goal in the long term, particularly in all nations, is to reduce our dependency on fossil fuels. And we always keep saying that natural gas is a bridge. While we're building out our renewable energy infrastructure. And of course, Massachusetts is one of the leaders in wind because we have one of the bigger wind contracts in the United States. But we're providing greater assistance on getting this to go. And Massachusetts is going to be the place to go to build a lot of these parts or assembling a lot of these parts for this offshore wind. It's part of also economic development. European countries actually are somewhat ahead of us on this.
Yes.
But again, it does take time to build.
It's never been a real priority in this country until, in recent times. So, like you say, it is going to take a little while to build out the infrastructure. Do you think that this situation, though, this Ukrainian situation will expedite that?
Well, I think it'll expedite the move towards renewables on a global level in terms of getting on the wagon to do it. Now, the actual building infrastructure is not going to go any faster than they can go. that's just reality. I mean, wind is desirable in a lot of places because of the fact that it doesn't depend on sunshine. And has a, you know, particularly up here in New England, has a reliability rate closer to 60%, meaning that 60% of the time the windmill will generate power. Solar is closer to 25 to 30% reliable out of, you know, of the time, as opposed to natural gas, which is 99.9%. Same with hydro. If we ever get that transmission line done, as we said, I say again, infrastructure is not exactly like you can do overnight. You know, that's also 99.9% is hydro reliability. Mm-hmm. So for wind to be viable, you need a lot of windmills to offset the reliability of it. So 60% is the maximum potential reliability for big wind in the area. You know, on the other end of it, you're looking at like 40%, you know, on the other side, unless you get like a nor'easter category 2 hurricane, then the windmills have to stop.
Right. Yeah.
They'll burn out the turbines. The windmills are spinning too fast. Spin too slow, you can't generate enough electricity to get the turbines to the right speed to generate power.
Has to be Goldilocks, has to be just right.
Just right. Which is why Uplock Island has the highest reliability component. But as we've seen, this is New England. We get a lot of crazy storms.
True.
And, but I mean, there's a whole science to it, which is why I'm still a big proponent of hydro to get off of natural gas, because if the windmills are hit a major storm, you know, we have hydro, we can ask for more hydro to come down and try not to have to ignite the natural gas if we don't have to.
Yeah. Whatever happened to, I know there was research being done into wave generating technology, you know, using ocean waves to generate power.
Yeah, it's called tide mill.
Okay.
Those who know tide mills know that, you know, they used to use the tides coming back and forth to spin the mills. And the issue of wave technology, again, is a reliability issue because the tides don't move. You need perfect tidal to move. And that's like near impossible these days, especially with climate change.
Yeah.
And then its scope of size. So, you know, I've seen technology that uses relatively small devices, which actually isn't bad if you're on a boat. You need to charge your cell phone. You can use wave technology for that. But if you want to build it out, you know, you would need to fill like all of Boston Harbor.
I see. Okay.
And then it'd be impractical. And then there's also, I remember one guy came up with this idea on a model on using something the size of a cruise ship to use wave technology. But again, you know, building a cruise ship takes like 6 years.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of people with ideas, but the initial startup cost is going to be like $500 million. And your ability to recoup that against the ratepayers could take you like 100 years.
Oh, right. Okay. So we're not there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you're paying for this in your electric bill, folks. It isn't free.
Right.
And if they can't build it in a timely manner at a reasonable cost, it really doesn't help any of us. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk about wave technology. I'm sure there's other ones I don't know about. But again, it's a scaling problem and a reliability problem.
Yeah, it's, you know, and interestingly, the one that nobody's talked about that's been around for decades and decades is nuclear power. You know, that just seems to be a pariah. Nobody wants to go there.
Well, exactly. We talked a bit about this a little last time, and the Manhattan Project pretty much killed, that movie killed, single-handedly killed nuclear power in the United States because people have a perception that, you know, at any moment you're going to get radiated. And again, NIMBY, no one wants one of these in the backyard. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants a giant windmill in the backyard. No one wants a whole solar farm in the backyard. And this continues to be a reality in a densely urban area. If you want to volunteer your space in your backyard and not have your neighbors murder you over it, I mean, be my guest. But this is a real issue. I was conversing with Moore Healy about this regarding renewable power. But at the same time, we need coastal defenses. And it's easy to make public policy if you know it's not going to be in your backyard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As I like to say, sorry, that was my computer for some reason. I don't know what it is. It just pinged. Oh. Sorry on that. I live more of a kind of like, you know, with like, I'm in like my backyard situation because of, you know, coastal defenses issue and the climate change impact on my constituents and actually everybody along the South Shore. So I'm kind of like, yeah, we need more renewables, but I need coastal defenses. And that was actually one of the things I talked to Maura Healy about. You can't just focus on one about the other.
Also, since last we talked, Techie, the State House is open again. How's that going?
No, no big surprise. Nobody's coming.
I mean, okay.
this is the thing that I was always kind of baffled in my mind. I do understand that people want to do things on principle and also put my employees at risk. I mean, I find it amazing that, you know, well, I'm in danger. You should be too. I'm like, no, that is just callous thinking. But also no big surprise. No tours are coming in. Kids are not lining up to visit a state house. People who do business with us are still working in this video format. The meetings I've been getting requests for continue to be in a Zoom format. They the ones who ask for it, not me. And, you know, we are providing a skeleton staff. We have a full contact tracing component. So I don't want to have all my staff sick simultaneously if one of them somehow, unfortunately, gets Omicron, because that's when Omicron B2 apparently now. You know, I do not want my entire staff down at the same time. We are having a contract tracing. If you somehow visit my office, you're filling out a form, folks. You don't like it? I'm sorry. If someone in my office catches it, we're going to tell you we got it. So I think that's crucially important. If somehow I get it or staff member gets it, you have to be in my office at a time, we're going to give you a phone call and tell you that you need to get tested right away. That's responsibility is what I call that. Mm-hmm. We had a long talk among ourselves and trying to figure out the best way to do it. But you know, thus far, other than some of the regulars who come to the state house, normally pretty much people that have business with us, you know, a lot of the lobbyists, government affairs folks, I do not expect people just coming in to use the state house library and hang out all afternoon. Mm-hmm. I'm not expecting that. And we'll know better once we get to April vacation week, which is when a lot of the tourists start coming in for the Boston Marathon, which I'm not quite sure what's happening with that. And, you know, once we get to May, June, and July is when we see the height of tourism, once we get to graduation season for colleges. And the families stay around for extra amount of time and they do the Freedom Trail tours and we see them come in. But no big surprise to me. All the people who say, open the state house. Well, you guys want it open. Come visit.
Yeah, it's proof of vaccination or a negative test. Is that right?
Proof of full vaccination, two shots, and you have to do a negative test within the past 24 hours.
Okay.
So if you've been asking to open state house and you listen to me, well, you say you want it open, come visit, folks.
And a mask requirement, right?
Common areas require a mask. Employees in the private spaces are not required a mask. It's discretion of the office for whether to mask. We have decided in my office that whenever at all possible, if there's guests in the office, we will be masked and we ask people to mask as well.
Okay. But I mean, the numbers do seem to be trending in a better direction, certainly.
Oh, absolutely. We're moving to a better space, but I still would recommend against being in large crowds. Still, I am not doing a campaign kickoff again, because I don't want to put people in a small room together. I have been able to generate, you know, 100, 150 people. It is the winter. It's going to be, you know, I can't do an outdoor event. Nomination papers are going to be a little tricky this time, just like municipal elections. People have to find creative ways to get people to sign. And of course, in 2020, you know, a lot of folks are finding ways to get signatures done as well. So, you know, I'll get there. It's going to take a little longer than normally it would. But, you know, my personal advice is still is that, you know, large crowded area, and likely people will be less likely to wear a mask. Omicron is an asymptomatic carrier. We all know that the infection rate is underreported. Not everybody at home with a take-home test calls DPH to report that. It's only tests that are done in the lab that medical facilities report to DPH. So yeah, the numbers are great, but I think it was like 61 deaths yesterday.
Yes. Yep.
61. I mean, it was still in double digits on a regular basis. So the numbers are much lower, but people are still dying. Well, that means we're into the 23,000 people since this began. In case you're wondering, in Korea, South Korea, I mean, there are 219 new infections yesterday. Hong Kong's crossing the 30,000 barrier a day. And even Singapore, which is both Hong Kong and Singapore in particular, very controlled environment regarding gatherings and closings and closing a lot of businesses. You know, it's crossed the 24,000 barrier as well. But, you know, Singapore's death rate is like low numbers. They're like 17 people, 4 people, really low numbers. And they're actually managing the hospital system well. Hong Kong, on the other hand, has no more space in the morgue.
Wow.
They got refrigeration trucks now for bodies. It's not just Omicron and COVID. It's death of natural causes that occur. on day to day. So it's now you got a pileup situation where you got people dying from COVID, but you also have, unfortunately, a natural course of life deaths on top of that. And this is the fear that we had here in Massachusetts, that somehow, some way, you know, we were able to weather more than one storm without the system completely collapsing, even though people don't realize there were also refrigeration trucks at big hospitals who here, an overflow of death and funeral homes, unable to keep up with the volume.
Yeah, you can never ever see that again. But exactly. Well,
people don't see that in news. I mean, I talk to funeral home directors, and more people than they can deal with, more passings they can handle. But I mean, it doesn't make the news, and unless you're an individual that works in the industry or have a lot of close contact in the situation, it isn't real till you see it.
The voting rights bill, Techie, has that now been resolved at the State House in terms of early voting, mail-in voting?
Still in conference committee.
Okay.
Yeah, we're still hold it. Let me get my date straight. This thing, you keep doing this to me every week and I get very confused because I'm doing too many things at one time. in the Senate, waiting for action, I think. Is it? No, conference committee. We're in conference committee. We're still in conference committee. That was a conference committee. So I just keep trying to keep track of this stuff. It's getting to that stage where I have to try to pretend things are now popping, and we're getting a whole lot of emails from internal emails now about things that may or may not be moving, and the budget's rolling around fast. I have a budget meeting next week of Ways and Means. And we're still trying to track down my own bills on action because it's not reported in either our internal system or on the website that the clerk actually reports action. And we're very respectful of the fact that all the committees getting inundated with phone calls. So it's not like a major crisis. You know, we can wait on the website because it doesn't matter. I can't do anything anyway till the clerk reads it in. Yeah. So knowing sooner about an action doesn't help me because we have to wait for the paperwork to process anyway. Okay. So that's one thing we're doing this week, a lot of tracking down. So, as you can tell, I'm starting to get a little confused because we're hitting that part of the season.
It's going to ramp up quickly and then it'll be over at the end of June, right?
No, we're end of July.
Oh, okay.
We're not municipal. People keep forgetting that. We go longer than the municipal. So, we go into campaign mode, or we're actually campaign season break, for lack of a better term. You know, starting August 1st. Okay. So, July stuff is, people know July 4th is very busy in Quincy. And you try to manage the end of a legislative schedule, trying to make your obligation. And given the fact that, you know, July 4th, like last year, is all outdoor-based events, obviously I'll be out there. But there's a reason it's starting to look more ragged as I move into the end of a legislative session. There's just so much going on at once. Put in perspective, folks, we have the budget. The governor filed a $2.4 billion supplemental budget. The governor's going to file a transportation bond. We have a capital improvement bond bill before us. We have, obviously, I talk about window a bill tomorrow under renewable power. You talk about the voting rights bill. We have, in my committee, like I have a gym bill rights that I want to see moving regarding better consumer protection regarding gyms. Other committees are looking at things like whether or not we're going to do expanded student education on ethics studies. That's kind of out there. We still got to deal with things like kids aren't going, still a slow getting back to school. Some kids just dropped off the map when school enrollment. We don't know how to handle that. Mm-hmm. Mental health continues to be a very big challenge. You know, I'm neck high in trying to resolve the issue regarding outdoor dining. We're still trying to find a smooth transition from no regulations to going back to regulations.
Right.
Outdoor dining doesn't end on an expiration date, everybody. It just means that you have to go by the normal building codes that you've been doing before COVID, that we've suspended, quite frankly, local folks and businesses, including inspectors and businesses and business associations, would like to go back to the code at some point. But it's transitioned back there. Where it's something I'm trying to figure out how to transition from nothing back to correctly.
I know here in Quincy, you do have to apply again, according to the city clerk, for an outdoor permit. Yeah.
Agreed. And I got to figure that stuff out on a new transition. Very political as well. A lot of different moving parts.
All right. Gives us plenty of material to talk about in the future.
Yeah. To get closer and closer to solving it, I can talk more about it because I have something better to say. Okay. But no, it's as I can tell, there's a lot going on at a number of different levels. The judiciary has been working on a hate crime incident reporting stuff. I talked to Chairman Day about it before, about how can we strengthen our hate crime reporting systems. There's a lot of things happening. I'm going to get more of ragged as we keep going deeper.
All right, well, maybe we'll switch over to audio only if at that point, Tacky.
That's what they all saw us with, like, bad haircuts and
dark circles under your eye.
Dark circles under your eye through the past 2 years. Why change now?
We need your contact information, if you please.
617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. You can reach us by phone, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. We do prioritize and get our constituent services out first. And if you can look at my state representative, Tacky Chan, Facebook. We are having a public hearing on March 14th at 1 p.m. regarding the ballot question for the expansion of retail alcohol licensing. So I do have a ballot question. I have to figure out what we're doing with or not doing with, as the case may be. I don't know yet. But we're going to have a public hearing on that. If you want to watch it on Facebook Live on March 14th, you can watch it there. And, of course, tackyinternet.org is still undergoing renovations, but we use it mostly as a service contact list. So you need to find QCAP's number or Cohesion Resources number or the YMCA, Germantown numbers, things like that we put on there that you can use as directory and save yourself some time.
All right. Sounds good. Always good, Tacky. Appreciate it.
Good to see you, Joe, and I'll see you in a week's time.